The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. On the show this week, author Simon Singh discusses the science of the Simpsons, exploring Homer and Bart's connections with Euler's equation and the topology of donuts. Also on the show, we'll look at the week's top science stories, including India's journey into space, revelations from the UN Climate Change Summit in New York, the British winner of this year's Ig Nobel Prize, and the discovery of water in the atmosphere of a Neptune-sized planet 120 light-years from Earth. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. In the studio today are Nicola Davis, commissioning editor of Observer Tech Monthly, and The Guardian's environment web editor, Adam Vaughan. Welcome both.
Hello. Hello.
Nicola, let's get started with you. Tell us about India getting one up on China.
Well, India has just succeeded in putting its Mars satellite in orbit, which is very exciting. In fact, it's sent back its first images now. So they're very happy bunnies in India. And of course, this has been hailed as being particularly exciting because it only cost $74 million compared to NASA's Maven Mars mission, which cost $671 million. So it's a snip at that price to send a satellite up there.
How did they manage to do it so cheaply?
They have a lot of components that were built in India itself, so that saves some costs. Also, they don't have quite as exotic a payload as the Maven satellite, so that probably also saves a buck or two. But it's still nevertheless an impressive achievement, and it will also be having a shifty at the atmosphere of Mars, which is, of course, full of promise. So they're hoping to reveal a little bit more about what was going on up there and what happened to the water that people believe was on Mars.
I think they were the first nation to pull off a mission to Mars the first time round, actually. Adam, $74 million, that sound like a good value for a Mars mission?
Well, I think my favourite headline when they announced this was, Indians put satellite in orbit around Mars for less than the price that it cost to make Gravity, as in the film with Sandra Bullock, which is great. But I suppose it does beg the question, which has certainly been debated in the Indian press, of whether spending $70 million on a satellite for looking and see how much methane is in Mars's atmosphere is a good use of money in a country where many people live on, less than a dollar a day. What do you think, Nicola?
There is that argument. It has certainly been aired quite widely. But on the other hand, India is has got a burgeoning science base now. And, we're always saying in the UK how much science underpins the growth of our economy and indeed our general well-being in this country. So I think to poo-poo or deny India their chance to forward their science programmes would be,
I don't think you should do any science until everyone's equal in the world. One question I am interested in is how important is measuring the amount of methane in Mars's atmosphere? I mean, surely some people have looked at that before.
It has been measured before, and I think what's interesting is if you can try and find a measurement that suggests there's a continuous amount of methane coming out that would otherwise be destroyed as soon as it reaches the atmosphere by the sunlight coming in and things like that, might tell you something about whether, this is an enormous long shot, it might tell you if there were methane being produced by some sort of bugs in the soil. I think this is extreme straw clutching by a lot of the astrobiologists and people who chip in on these kinds of missions. But this is about politics, isn't it? This is about demonstrating that you've got the technological know-how that you can do impressive stuff, that you can be part of that elite club. Yeah. And I suppose they're looking at China, who have Jade Rabbit, their rover on the moon, and China obviously being very aggressive in their space policy. They shot down a weather satellite to show they had this kind of anti-satellite capability, which has led India to look at anti-satellite capability. It's a very interesting area to watch Asia, and I think the US is watching that quite closely, because I think the US wants space to be very calm and very uncluttered and a civilized place, because they rely so much on it for militarily and for communications and all the rest of it. And if you start having, other nations up there who are playing by different rules, it could be a bit destabilizing. But the whole thing is just interesting to watch, because India obviously sees itself as an Asian technology leader. Where does China come, and what does that mean for their sense of national identity and so on? So I think that's what this is all about. Nicola?
Well, yeah, and I believe that the UK is collaborating with India on various space missions and things as well. So obviously it's not just India that sees itself in this role, but much of the Western world as well is beginning to see them as, you know, real sort of force in the space race. And that's a really great thing.
And to watch a video from India's mission control, head to theguardian.com/science. Last week I wrote about astronomers' excitement at having detected water vapour in the atmosphere of a planet that was well beyond our own solar system. It was in the journal Nature, and they described how they found this Neptune-sized planet with cloud-free skies, enabling them to make these detailed measurements of a small planet's atmosphere for the first time. The problem was that before, a lot of the planets of that kind of size they had tried to look at were so covered in cloud that they couldn't actually get to see what was in the atmosphere, that their measurements just weren't working. And it was getting to the point where they wondered if all of the planets around that kind of size were going to be really shrouded in cloud and cause some problems. And that was going to raise this issue that there may be problems if you find a sort of a second Earth, another small rocky planet that you want to start looking at the atmosphere on. If those rules applied there, that you wouldn't really be able to get any good measurements of the atmosphere there. What I liked about this was they found a planet that was actually pretty clear, hardly had any cloud cover on it. And so what they could do is, as the planet moved in front of its parent star, they could look to see how the starlight coming into their camera on the Hubble Space Telescope, they could see how the absorption of different wavelengths of light changed as the planet went across. And so you have this tiny, it must be an incredibly sensitive measurement. You have this tiny cover of atmosphere around the planet as it moves in front of its star, and you can actually detect how many wavelengths and what sort of wavelengths of light are lost because they're absorbed in the atmosphere as the planet crosses the star. And they found that the signature of that absorption was consistent with water being in the atmosphere. So water vapor being there, and they find that it's mostly hydrogen with about 25% water in the atmosphere. I think it's kind of a nice demonstration of what you might be able to do in the future as NASA gets its James Webb Space Telescope up in 2018 that will look at really be well tuned to look at these kinds of atmospheres.
As I understand it, I mean, this is not at all a sort of life is out there story. It's really is about the, and it's not so even really a technology breakthrough. It's just about this clever technique, isn't it? I mean, can you just talk us through that a bit more about how they, I mean, you have alluded to a bit about how they were able to detect it.
One of the easiest ways to look for an exoplanet, a planet beyond our own solar system, is to have a camera that stares out into space at loads of stars, and you look for a periodic dimming, a regular cycle of dimming of the light coming from that star. That can be caused when a planet goes across the face of the star. And the ones you pick up really early on are obviously the ones where they're really big planets, like your Jupiters, your gas giants, and the ones that are really close to the stars, because those are the ones that have, they circle the stars in days. So this planet is nowhere near as big as a Jupiter. It's just about four times larger than our own Neptune. And it goes around the planet, a year on this planet lasts 5 Earth days. So it's got a really quick orbit. So you would see the light from that star dim every 5 days as the planet goes across the face of the star, as long as you're looking in the plane of its orbit with the camera. So the nice thing about this was, if you can then look at how the spectrum of the light coming from the star changes as the planet goes across, you can work out how much of the light is being absorbed by the atmosphere of that planet. And obviously, if it's covered in high altitude clouds, all you get is all of the light drops off, because none of it gets through the atmosphere, none of it gets through the clouds, it's all absorbed. But if you have clear skies, then you just pick up what's in the atmosphere. It's like it's transmission spectroscopy, basically. You have a lot of white light from the star coming through, and you see what colors emerge the other side. It tells you what has been absorbed in the atmosphere, and that tells you again what chemicals, what molecules are in that atmosphere. In this case, about 25% water. So you get an idea of the concentration of it as well. So it just says, you know, in the future, can you use this system? Can you use more sensitive equipment that you'll have on the James Webb telescope to look at that kind of thing? Can you even start thinking of looking at biosignatures, which would be proportions of various gases in the atmosphere that you wouldn't get in equilibrium if there wasn't something producing them down on the surface, i.e. cows and plants and things like that.
Were they surprised that there was water in the atmosphere, or was that something that was sort of expected? Or
I don't think they were surprised that there was water in there. They were just relieved to find that they could do the measurement more than anything, because there's water around in an awful lot of places, either bound into minerals or wafting around in the atmosphere of various planets. So to actually see the water there wasn't quite such a surprise, just to actually confirm it was nice, that's all.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Adam, you were covering the UN Climate Change Summit in New York last week. What happened there?
So last week on Tuesday, 120 leaders came from around the world to meet at the UN in New York at the behest of Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General. Amongst them was David Cameron, Barack Obama, but there were some notable no-shows from China, India, Russia, to discuss climate change, which in itself is maybe doesn't seem that exciting. You know, a load of world leaders coming together to talk about global warming, but actually this is the first time people of that seniority have come together in 5 years to talk about climate change. The last time was in Copenhagen, the landmark climate summit in 2009, which didn't end very well and ended up a bit quite embarrassing for people like Obama. So, you know, the stakes are high in a way, just even getting people of that sort of status together to come and talk about the issue. And there was a lot of talk. Let's not get carried away. There were free rooms where concurrently 120 world leaders, you know, gave 4-minute speeches, although none of them kept the time. And there was lots of, you know, nice rhetoric. But there was actually some modest but solid announcements as well. There was some new cash on the table for helping poorer countries adapt to climate change. So there's this thing called the Green Climate Fund. France, which is going to host the big climate talks next year, coughed up, said it was going to give $1 million to that, and there was another 300 million or so from various other countries as well.
It sounds like there's a lot of nice sort of words and lots of good talk and lots of sort of, you know, oh yes, we must do something sort of noises coming out of this. But in terms of actual action plans, I mean, surely that's where everything breaks down. What was the kind of consensus on that?
You're quite right. It wasn't really about action. I mean, it was not part of the official international sort of negotiating process on climate change. The idea is it's to bring together, rather than like getting bogged down in the nitty-gritty of like which countries should achieve emissions cuts of X by when, which is really what it was all going to boil down to in reality. It was about that sort of grand gesture stuff and about having people like Obama and Cameron talking about this issue. And I mean, to be fair, in a way, it's quite interesting because a lot of these people, because it's been so long since world leaders have talked about this issue, a lot of these people haven't even given a speech on climate change before because some of them hadn't been in office the last time around. So for some people, they're talking like, you know, Dilma Rousseff of Brazil, for example. This, I mean, she's probably given speeches on climate change at home before, but, you know, on the world stage like that is a big deal. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people will obviously and have already criticised it as a talking shop. But nonetheless, it, you know, just the mere fact of it happening also brought about, which I think is something we'll probably see in hindsight as being more significant, it ended up with a reported sort of 500,000 plus people coming out around the world on Sunday for marches. You know, there's 30,000-40,000 in London, and apparent, if you believe the organisers, 400,000 in New York. And I think, you know, that in itself, that's really, I think that is really interesting. You know, 500,000 people coming out to protest about an abstract long-term issue is quite a big deal, and that wouldn't have happened without the summit itself.
Sure, I mean, that's definitely a very encouraging sign, and it certainly sort of seems to be a movement that's gathering speed, which is really great. But isn't there a danger that, like the Copenhagen summit that you referred to, you know, it's going to be another however many years before they get together again, and then it's going to be yet another chance to stand up and make a nice-sounding speech? What you actually need, surely at some point, is people to put their cards on the table, to agree some sort of action plan.
So what's important here is this meeting was a sort of inject momentum into the official sort of international climate talks process, which happens under the aegis of the UN. And there is a deadline for that countries agreed a few years ago in Durban. They agreed that by the end of 2015 in Paris, that they will come to a global overarching, for the first time, every country, all the major countries of the world, come together and agree something about cutting emissions. That, you know, that's the deadline. This is meant to, they've got like, in early next year, we'll get countries actually laying their cards on the table, talking about numbers. And the idea is that everything, all the sort of ducks are in a row, as it were, to use the cliche, you know, before the meeting comes. Because the problem was last time, you had people like Gordon Brown, Angela Merkel, you know, China, US coming, you know, world leaders coming together to thrash out the nitty gritty of like a, you know, of a the small print on a document, which is just madness. I mean, you know, that in hindsight, you know, that the idea is now that it'll be a bit more choreographed and come Paris next year,
it's really just a case of rubber stamping it.
How confident are you that they're going to keep up this momentum that this New York meeting has brought about to take them through to Paris, where so they'll actually make some meaningful headway there?
I think that's a really good question. I think one of the things which will be really interesting to see over the next year and a bit is whether the public pressure remains there, because that mandate has to be there. And if politicians don't think there's votes in this and they don't think people care about this, then they can just park it or you know, do some sort of watered down compromise. So I think, you know, whether if there are further marches and general sort of civic society mobilising on this, then that will help keep up the pressure. And Avaz, who were the sort of digital campaigning lot who were behind a lot of these marches, you know, if they can replicate that sort of efficiency, which was actually quite impressive, you know, I think then they have a good chance. I mean, I think it also is going to depend on, you know, things like economic circumstances. I mean, like, you know, Copenhagen happened at a very bad time. It happened just after the financial crash. And really, like, long-term issues like saving the world from runaway climate change weren't really high on many leaders' agenda, but it looks like we might be entering a slightly more clement environment for that this time round.
This must be an incredibly tough thing for India, though, because it's quite rich for other countries to say you can't grow yourself out of poverty the same way all those other countries have done by burning all their coal and what have you. I mean, to expect another country to deal with that handicap themselves is tough.
It is tough for India and China. And, you know, I mean, they can point and say, like, look, historically, you know, most of the emissions have come from you. And we've got a fabulous map on our site that shows exactly that. But the reality is, as well, is that they are both growing so fast that they've actually caught up in many ways with the West. The average Chinese person now has the same carbon footprint as someone in Europe. It's not an easy problem to solve because, you know, they do have to address poverty and inequality there. But at the same time, the atmosphere doesn't really care, you know, where the carbon comes from. And we are, there's Nature Climate Change, just the journal the other day, there was a truly sort of terrifying paper about where we're on in terms of global carbon emissions. We're on, like, last year we were on like 36 billion tons of carbon dioxide that year. And just to put that in context, it was on about 32 in 2010. And basically, if you look at the graph, we are on the top of those, like, worst case scenario emission, those what they call like emissions pathways, which we've been, like, you know, we've been seeing for like more than a decade or so. And everyone was like, oh, it's okay, we'll peak things by 2020. And you look at the graph, we're really not going like that. It's going up like a rocket.
I don't know about China, but presumably India is going to be one of those nations that's going to be hit by a lot of the impacts of climate change, right?
Yeah, that's very true. And the one interesting thing, if you talk to people who are experts in sea level, is that sea level rise is not going to be equal. And in fact, that whole Southeast Asia region is just because of the way the world is, it's actually much more vulnerable to sea level rises there.
And to read Adam's blog and the rest of our coverage on the Climate Change Summit, head to theguardian.com/environment. Once again, researchers in Britain have been honoured with that most coveted of scientific awards, the Ig Nobel Prize. This year, Amy Jones's work with Mina Lyons at Liverpool Hope University revealed that people who habitually stay up late are, on average, more self-admiring, manipulative, and psychopathic. I asked Amy about the work that's won that prize.
It was basically a study combining three different topics. And I think what's made it stand out is maybe I looked at two topics that had never been studied together before. While I was trying to work out what to do for my dissertation, I'd noticed that whether you're more of a morning person or an evening person was linked to things such as high mating success, which was an area I was interested in. And then at the other side, the personality trait known as the dark triad, which is made up of three traits. One is psychopathy, which is having low levels of empathy, you know, impulsivity, aggressiveness. And there's Machiavellianism, which is more social, so you take opportunities to get places. And then narcissism, so these people are usually quite vain, manipulative, arrogant, but they're all very similar. No one's ever looked at the dark triad and chronotype before. I wonder if there's a link.
So you wondered whether there might be more of those pretty unpleasant traits among people who were either more night people or more morning people, right?
That's it. Well, more with the evening people, because they were the ones who tended to have more success. and so do people with the dark triad. So I was looking particularly if the evening types were linked in with the dark triad.
So what do you actually do in the study?
So it was just a questionnaire, filled it out. So it was a questionnaire to see how high you scored on the dark triad. There was a questionnaire for chronotype, so assessing whether you're a morning type or an evening type. And then there was a set of questions asking about your success in life, so like how many sexual partners they'd had, questions like that. So it was kind of three questionnaires all jumbled into one.
And what do you actually find from it then?
My study was 70% females and 30% males, so I only actually found any significant results with the females in my study. And what I found was that psychopathy and narcissism from the dark triad were linked in with the evening chronotype. So that was quite interesting, but more studies need to look at this because it's the first study that has linked them together.
So two of the traits were, you found those in the women. What would those women be like then with those traits?
What I should probably stress is if you do score high on psychopathy, it doesn't mean that you're going to grab an axe and start murdering people. That's not what it is. First of all, I'd stress that, because if you tell someone they're a psychopath, you think they're calling them a serial killer.
Yeah.
And you're not. It's quite a good trait to have, really. It just means you've got low levels of empathy, so you find it quite hard to kind of understand why people are acting the way they are or put yourself in their shoes. You're emotionally stable, though. You don't get drawn in to other people's problems. But you can be quite manipulative, quite impulsive, and sometimes quite aggressive.
And what was the other trait?
And then we've got narcissism. So these are people who are, again, manipulative and quite arrogant. You know, they think they're the centre of the universe. Not that I'm saying all evening types are going to be like that, but you're going to find that people who tend to stay up a bit late and have a bit more confidence, you know, a bit more impulsive, do things on the spur of the moment.
And when you look at what these people do in life, you said you rated them, their sort of levels of success. What do you mean by success? What happens to these kind of people? Do they end up in prison or in politics?
Well, it depends which way they go, really. I mean, you could say a successful psychopath is going to end up in all of the high-end jobs, so like in charge of companies, you know, making millions. And then the unsuccessful psychopaths, you could perhaps say, are the ones that end up in jail committing crimes.
On the plus side, Machiavellianism didn't seem to feature in those people.
No, unfortunately not. And it was the one least linked to the other two traits, psychopathy and narcissism, which might explain why I found the results that I found.
Does it mean that morning people are actually less successful? Because there's often sort of, in my mind, I think of early risers as being sort of good and straight-laced people who are cracking on early in the morning while everyone else is still in bed.
Yeah, as the saying goes, the early bird catches the worm, but it does not seem to be the case. Not at all. It's all a lie. Stay in bed, you know. There's no point getting up in the morning.
The advantages of being the late worm.
Exactly.
Amy Jones there, winner of the Ig Nobel Prize for Psychology. What time do you two go to bed?
Well, I've got two young children, so I go to bed as early as I blooming can. I usually go to bed about 10, which is really old man-ish.
Wow.
Yeah.
You probably stay up really late, don't you?
I do.
Quite consistently.
In my defence, I get up at 6, so...
But apparently the self-admiring, manipulative and psychopathic types are actually very successful because they're quite cold, don't mind trampling on people and tend to be the sorts of people who run companies. Last year on the podcast, Alok spoke to the author, broadcaster and libel law crusader Simon Singh about his book The Simpsons and Their Mathematical Secrets. Now Simon's back on Science Weekly, this time with Al Jean, head writer and executive producer for The Simpsons, and suspected by Simon to be one of the masterminds behind the heavy maths content packed into the show.
That's right. I was joined by Simon, Al, and executive producer of Futurama, David X. Cohen, who dropped in to talk to me more about the maths behind The Simpsons. I started by asking Al about the processes by which mathematics started to get included in The Simpsons.
Well, I won't say that we started this show as a pro-math agenda, intending to, like, you know, convert children into people doing differential equations, you know, under their parents' noses. But what happened was there were a lot of writers who had math degrees, and we always just thought that it wouldn't be a show just for kids. It would be something that would have, you know, multi-levels, and that we would put things in that, you know, you might not get at once, but you might get when you're older. And math was one of them. We're very happy that people have observed it and actually taken it.
That's fantastic. I mean, a lot of the references are quite fleeting. There's a fantastic scoreboard example, I know, that Simon flagged up in his book, where you have these, you know, it looks like just three innocuous numbers on the back of the scoreboard, but actually there's more to it than meets the eye. How much time and effort goes into actually incorporating the jokes? Are they just sort of off the cuff, or are they things that are thought about quite deeply?
For some reason, the single cell like sign jokes that we do take about 5 hours each. It's the least productive way to work, you know, devoting your attention to the thing people don't even pay attention to. But we do. We put in, and I would say Futurama, you know, David's worked on both shows, is even more intensive in that way.
So there was the example where Apu is taking the witness stand, and in order to justify how good a memory he has, he says that he can remember pi to 40,000 decimal places. The writers, you were emailing top mathematicians to try and get the 40,000th digit of pi.
Yeah, right? This was before the internet, so it was much harder to you didn't just like look it up and have the answer in a second. We had, who would know this?
there's a lovely fax that David Bailey, who was the NASA mathematician who worked out, he still has that fax. And you know, he was astounded. He was one of the world authorities on pi, and he's very happily delivering the 40,000th digit.
Get those supercomputers rolling. It's the Simpsons on the line.
David, there's a point where Homer is battling out an invention on the chalkboard. And actually, is there a secret facet of Homer that we don't know about? Is he actually a mathematical genius? Because he knows a lot about the mathematics of donuts, if I'm right.
Homer has extensively studied the geometry of the donut. And the particular joke you're talking about, I think, is a topology joke for you topology fans out there, where Homer has converted the donut, which has one hole, into what is mathematically a sphere by biting a chunk out of it. So he has proven that all of mathematics is wrong and worthless with one bite.
To what extent do you think that animation and maths goes hand in hand? Is it a medium that lends itself to these kind of fleeting jokes more than just a normal TV production?
Yeah, definitely. I know Al has some theories on this too, so I won't quote him as I often do. But I mean, one of the main reasons for these math jokes is because in animation you get to see the show when it's half done and you go, oh my God, there's a lot of blank space on that wall back there. And after you stare at it three times, you say, it's starting to look kind of boring. We better fill it up with something quick. And that's when you send the people out for 5 hours and say, write something funny that goes there. So if you send out me or one of the math nerds, we might come back with an equation to stick up there.
Do you have a quota for the number of math jokes you try to get in? Is there a kind of, you know, a bit of competition between the writers of who can get the most gags into a show?
Well, I remember in the Brief History of Time, Stephen Hawking said his editor said every equation he included would reduce sales by one half. So he said he was only including one equation, E equals MC squared. So I think that if you put it too front and center, I know there's a huge, you know, math audience out there, but there isn't a quota and there isn't, you know, it's, you just try to put in extra things as much as possible, and you are really thrilled when anybody notices them.
Well, Simon obviously is somebody who's noticed quite a lot of them. Do you have a favourite that you picked up?
Gosh, I mean, you mentioned the chalkboard earlier in The Wizard of Evergreen Terrace, and Dave explained that there's the donut topology reference there. There's also a reference to the mass of the Higgs boson, which you know, appeals to me because my background's in particle physics. And there's also a reference to Fermat's Last Theorem. And my first book was all about Fermat's Last Theorem. And Fermat's Last Theorem crops up in Doctor Who, Star Trek, Bedazzled, that great film with Liz Hurley, Stieg Larsson novels. You know, so Fermat's, it's so glamorous, it pops up everywhere. But when it pops up in The Simpsons, it has this added twist of being a clever prank, a hoax, which I think you generated the false
solution. It was me. I had actually come relatively recently from graduate school where I was studying theoretical computer science, so I still knew how to operate a computer back then. The head writers, Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein at that time, asked me to write an equation to be floating in the background of a 3D scene we were doing. I said, sure, and I went home and I started scratching my chin and I said, why don't I put my skills to use here? So I wrote a program that would find near misses to disprove Fermat's Last Theorem, which interestingly was just being proven after hundreds of years at about the time we were writing this. So to disprove it was actually topical at that time. So this equation was put in the background, and if you tried it out on a calculator, it would appear to be correct to 8 digits. And if that was true, it would disprove this famous theorem. So we hid that in the background, and I lurked on the internet the next day after it aired, and I saw someone responding and saying, how can this be? I've typed in my calculator and it can't be true, but it's true. What's going on? And I got so excited, I was jumping up and down. And I did it.
Do you
guys were just kind of like always capitalizing like on, you know, the pro format furor in the mid-90s.
Do you get a lot of people writing in saying, you know, do you know that that number's not any old number? Do you realize that's a prime number? I mean, do you get people kind of trying to catch you out at your own game at
all? Well, my theory now is that people, immediately solve everything much faster. Like the groupthink of the internet probably would have, the joke had come out today, would have like figured it out and had the, you know, I sent some tweet that it was like a really cryptic thing that I thought, oh, how soon will they figure this out? And it was 1 hour they had it all figured out completely.
We did something similar in the pilot of Futurama. There's this secret code which is given as an alien language, but really it's a substitution code where each symbol is a letter of the English alphabet. And we thought, oh, we'll hide that, and over the years, you know, we'll add messages and see when people decode it. And of course, about 12 minutes after the pilot was on, they had decoded the whole thing already. So we said, we better come up with a harder one.
In our crossover, oh, go ahead.
So you did come up with a hard one because Jeff Westbrook joined, and Jeff was a professor at Yale. You know, again, it's another one of these mathematically minded people. And one of his first jobs on the show at Futurama was to come up with a better code.
That's right. Whichever mathematician we most recently stole from academia has to do the math joke. So he constructed a much harder code, and that one took at least 12 hours for the bands to break.
If we see the crossover we did with Futurama, at the end we have some stuff in the code, and one of the things, if you solve it, it says, congratulations, you're a nerd.
Are there any fantastic bits of maths that didn't quite make the cut, that were just a bit too niche, or that you thought someone was going a little bit, you know, off on a tangent?
I think math has never been cut.
It's inherently so funny.
Simon, so obviously you've spotted a lot of the maths here and brought it to our attention, which is fantastic. Are there other shows that are doing this as well? I mean, The Simpsons seems pretty special in this respect.
Yeah, I mean, the writers were great in terms of telling me lots of bits I hadn't noticed, and there are a couple of academics in America who've been researching this as well, but I kind of brought it all together, and there are other shows. So you know, everyone says, you know, The Big Bang Theory's got a huge amount of maths in it and physics, and is there a book to write about Big Bang Theory? But that's not a surprise. You know, there are great books. I think there's The Physics of Star Trek and The Science of Doctor Who, and those are great books and lovely. But what's beautiful about Futurama and The Simpsons is that you don't expect the maths to be there. You know, you expect science to be in a science fiction show, but you don't expect so much maths to be there. So it's the surprising value of it, the surprising existence of this maths that's so beautiful. I started writing this book about 10 years ago. And for 10 years, I've been saying to people, I'm writing a book about The Simpsons and mathematics, or Futurama and mathematics. And people were just perplexed. But and then they think you're they think you're kind of fabricating it, and you're just kind of making up relationships which aren't really there. But the more you look, the more you find. Pythagoras' theorem, jokes about calculus. You mentioned there was a scoreboard in a Marge and Homer turn a couple play. There's a perfect number, a prime number, a Mersenne prime number, a narcissistic number. There is tons of this stuff there.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, maths is, you know, taking centre stage here, but are there other disciplines that are you know, also feeding in? You know, is chemistry going to get its day in The Simpsons and Futurama, or is it very much maths orientated for the little in-jokes?
Well, Simon points out in his book that there have been books on the religion of The Simpsons, the philosophy of The Simpsons, and I actually think math is the one is the most intentionally put in. You know, everybody has this sort of same view on the show of mathematics as opposed to the diverse views on religion and philosophy. Mm-hmm. Anything, you know, art, I think, because we're animated, is, you know, one higher field that we definitely use a lot of.
Mm-hmm. I would also say U.S. presidential history. We have a bunch of presidential history nerds on both shows, and a lot of Lincoln jokes and stuff.
We actually used real audio from Theodore Roosevelt on one show. They're the only president who didn't turn us down. We tried to get him.
And Futurama, obviously, I mean, is that sort of the hardcore maths version of The Simpsons? Because The Simpsons is sort of quite sort of, you know, lightly thrown in. Futurama, you get the feeling that it's like, you know, even more intense.
It fits a little more naturally in Futurama. Even so, when we started Futurama, we were very nervous about putting too much math or science in there because we were afraid of turning off the Simpsons audience. We didn't know what would happen. And over the years, we realized that, the fans were getting pretty excited about it. And, you know, our fan base leans in that direction. So we got a little more bold about it. And really the high point was an episode called The Prisoner of Benda, where there's actually a mathematical theorem proven in the episode. And it's the climactic moment of the episode. We actually flashed this theorem on screen, and the episode was written by Ken Keeler, who has a PhD in applied math, so he was the guy for the job.
Do you have a favorite maths moment?
I would say that Simon had alluded to the scoreboard, you know, because it could have just, it was a minor league game where all the numbers were around. It was guess the attendance, and it was about 8,000.
So if it was a major league game, you'd expect to see some good numbers up there, right? For a minor league game.
I think that was Westbrook, too, that came up with the numbers.
Just the level of attention. So one of the numbers is a Mersenne prime, and one of the numbers is a perfect number. And the writers could have picked any old numbers because there are lots of interesting numbers. But the interesting thing about Mersenne primes and perfect numbers is that they're an equal number of each. They're somehow married to each other. There's a correlation between them. Mm-hmm. And so, again, there's this extra level of thought that goes in. The number of even perfect numbers matches the number of Mersenne primes. And then the third one, Mersenne primes and perfect numbers are fairly well known, but the third type of number is a narcissistic number. I'd never heard of narcissistic numbers before I started watching The Simpsons.
They're very self-absorbed. They don't talk to other people. So.
The fact that Lisa was, you know, part of the mathletics team, or we sort of infer that she is from the dashed hopes of the mathletics team, and she nearly gets crushed in one episode. Is that a dig at, you know, the sort of, you know, enthusiasm of the mathematicians on the behind the scenes of The Simpsons?
Well, I went to math camp, so I mean,
is Lisa your alter ego?
In some ways, yes. I mean, or all the writers, you know, tend to identify with Lisa and give voice to their thoughts through her. But I should say, you know, teasing an episode that there's going to be a huge math episode involving Lisa, where it turns out that they become a Waldorf school, which is where you don't have, you know, advanced technology. You just do things like from, you know, old rote devices. And so the math coach becomes groundskeeper Willie, who's like a math savant. So that's going to be next year.
That's fantastic. So it's very much still in the pipeline. There's going to be lots more maths for us all to spot.
Math is inexhaustible as a source for comedy. Yes.
Thanks so much for coming in. That was great to talk to you. Simon Singh, Our Gene, and David X. Cohen there. They were appearing together at the Science Museum last week. And Simon's book, The Simpsons and Their Mathematical Secrets, is out now in paperback.
That's all we have for you this week. So from me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code GUARDIAN.